Mr. Fisher, would it be all right if I tape recorded our conversation?
Yes. If you write something and want to check whether they meant what I said or something, I'd appreciate it. It's not a requirement. I'm not going to prove your final text, but I generally can clarify stuff when I speak.
Great. I'm very happy to do that. Is there an email that I could send it to you at?
Yes. I use fax. My secretary uses email, so
okay.
I get defended. 495-7818 is the fax.
495-7818. Okay, great.
Or you can call Linda back sometime and get her email address.
Okay, good.
That's an advantage for you.
Great.
What, my field has been negotiation for some time.
Sure.
And what, I realize is a mediator or a third party is really negotiating between, negotiating with both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And what I find is useful is to get the parties together and first establish communication between them, kind of open communication, and then build some kind of working relationship where they're both tackling the same problem together. They understand.
Mm-hmm.
They're working on what we can do. No one is negotiating. They may not make a commitment on behalf of anybody outside their own. They can commit themselves. I'll recommend this when I get home. I'll propose that when I get home. But to make the conversation easy, what they say is not a commitment. It may not be recorded outside the room without their permission. Of course, McLean with the television there, we had a little reality on that. But basically, the rules were understood. What they said there was not a commitment for anybody.
Right. Could you summarize for me how you felt about the McLean's project as it was published and as it turned out, given, you know, all of your experience?
Well, no, I thought it was successful.
Mm-hmm.
I think the people there learned a lot. The publication of it spread some of these ideas a little further. It perhaps directed attention to the fact that solutions are not the answer. People in Canada and everywhere else argue about the solution. What's the solution to, first of all, what's the solution here? And in every case, more important is the process by which they work together.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one of my teaching assistants was madly in love with a fellow law student, but they were fighting half the time. She would barge into my office after him sometime in our quarrel, and he'd go, excuse me, Roger, go out and deal with her. And after some weeks, they came in together holding hands, and they said, Roger, we want you to be the first to know we have solved our problem. We're getting married.
Oh, boy.
And I said, congratulations, sit down. You will now have more issues to deal with. Children, housing, jobs, location, furniture, what color to paint the walls, everything. And the question is not what's the right color to paint the wall, what right number of children they have. It's how you deal with that question, how you deal with the differences. And in most conflict situations, they're bound to be conflicting interests and conflicting perceptions. Can't be avoided.
Mm-hmm.
So the difference between war and peace is how we deal with those conflicting interests and conflicting perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
And do we understand how they see it? When I worked on Ecuador and Peru the last few years on their boundary problem, we had 12 people at Harvard, 6 Ecuadorians and 6 Peruvians. And the first assignment was to set a semicircle every other one facing some flip charts. I said, okay, I want you to know the person next to you well enough to introduce him or her to the group. I'll give you 30 minutes to talk with each other, and so you can present that person to the group. well, this is automatically the role of introducer is something you don't introduce them as a jerk. You say good things about them. That's kind of implicit.
Right.
So they're carrying on a conversation. I said, okay, let's get started. And the Peruvian admiral said, oh, I totally forgot to ask that question. I know nothing about my new friend except matters that are too personal to discuss. Give me a few more minutes to find out where he went to university. It turned out by pure chance, the first thing he said was, I almost couldn't get here because of my mentally retarded daughter. I was taking care of her. And the rector of Guayaquil University said, you have a mentally retarded daughter? So do I. And for the next 30 minutes, they both talked about how the problem and how to deal with it. Well, when they finish that and introduce each other, then I say, all right, now pair up with somebody else, and I want you to have now another half hour, an hour, in which you clarify points you think the other side misunderstands about your side. And when you're with the other person is talking and you're asking questions, you only ask honest questions. Not why are you such an idiot, but honest questions. And you take notes or everything that surprises you. And it's your turn to explain what your side's beliefs are misunderstood back to the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So the people in the group are learning, they're taking notes, and I never knew they thought that. I didn't understand the way they're worried about this and so forth.
Right.
And then you, as we go through a time together, it was a little bit different in Canada. I forgot exactly how we ran the whole thing. I talked a little bit about negotiation theory. But we divide it by rooms sometimes. They say, all right, write down the interests of the other side. And they're writing down your interests. And the group agree on a one-page statement of the primary interests of the other side. Photocopy that, give one to each member of the group, and go up and find a third partner and a new partner. And they edit that statement of that side's interest to the satisfaction of that individual.
Mm-hmm.
We don't argue, we edit it down. What are we getting wrong about this? Then the Peruvians all come back together again with six different edited versions. And now they're all arguing about Ecuador's interest. Well, she told me this. No, I think you got it wrong. They really care more about this. So they then produce a consolidated statement of interest on a flip chart. Each room is doing it to the other side. And then they come into the plenary room again. They put the flip charts on the wall. And they can edit and further changes as long as a majority of that group believes it ought to be made. So, if they're editing what the Peruvians did to their interests, they can change it. But that way, they really understand what the side cares about.
Right.
Then we start saying, okay, what are some things that might be done in the near future? Subjects to deal with, and there's border problems, there's language problems, there's religion problems, there's security issues, trade, whatever it is. And then they invent who could do what about those issues.
Right.
They put them on post-it slips over the wall. And if they find somebody from the other group who wants to work with them on that idea, they turn that idea into what I call a yesable proposition, an operational decision that could be made by somebody. We're going to set up propose a free trade zone on the border. We're going to do this or that about information, exchange newspaper columns back and forth to see if they understand, better understanding what's going on.
So
all of this is non-committal, going from interest to options to specific detailed options. And by that time, they're pretty good understanding.
Right. The process seems so wonderful, and it seems to have so much potential. And that McLean's editorial package did such an exceptional job of clarifying it. I'm wondering if going into that project, I mean, here's a major national publication, circulation of 2 million. I'm wondering if going into that project, you had any thoughts or hopes about what might result from it, from, you know, publishing so broadly, how this process works.
Well, I was concerned that the media, as frequently the case, would be looking for conflict, looking for controversy, reporting that, and the television in particular, would try and clarify the difference between the Quebec Libre people who want to be a sovereign Quebec and other Canadians who did not. That I was not, it came out better than I feared. I normally would not let the media get near such a meeting, because particularly people of a political future tend to talk to the media all the time. Now, we had enough going on there in that room so that it was, they were interested enough in what was taking place there. And the television cameras were kind of in the back of the room, non-obtrusively, and we forgot them fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm.
We went out to work outdoors on time, table outdoors, sunshine, beautiful day. And they brought their cameras out over their shoulder. I remember asking one Quebecer what he thought. And the over-the-shoulder camera came right up and stuck in his face, you know. And he said, "Roger, I was going to tell you something else, but when I'm talking to my constituents, this is what I say." And went right, bang, 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 right into the camera.
Right.
And I got, he was such a political figure that he had to be thinking of his constituents all the time. We're not backing down, we're understanding the enemy, we're in their points of view, so we won't, so we'll be able to fight them better. You know, it's just terrible. And so normally I keep the media as far away as I can.
Mm-hmm.
I do let people write about their experience and what they learned without quoting anybody by name. They can say, "I came to this impression, and what I learned here was this, and there's more worry about that than about this," so forth. But the media has such a powerful impact. I was thinking of the television. Now, McLean's came out, and Kevin, what's his name, the internet editor?
Doyle.
Kevin Doyle very much cared about it. He knew my work, and now that's why I got a hold of it. And he kept sufficient control over that to make the reporting, I thought, very fair.
Mm-hmm. All of the reporters at McLean's that I've talked to about it 8 years later still remember it as an exceptional experience, moving and persuasive.
Now, I think the critical dimensions, if you look at the dimensions of a negotiation or a conflict, one is communication. And that means listening as well as talking, saying what's on your mind and not for the record, explaining things. In other words, relationship, how you treat the other side, as an adversary, or do you sit side by side when you're working at the table? You treat them as colleagues with whom you're working. Then on the table, it's not the position for the party, but their interests. What are their primary concerns? On both sides, understanding what their concerns, what they feel about it. When they say sovereignty, you want to know, well, really, what's sovereignty got to do? What are you worried about? Is the language being beat down? Lack of self-government? What are your underlying wants and needs? Then you get options. What are some possible ways of meeting those interests? What are some things we might do to meet those interests? And then you have criteria or standards by which to judge those options so they're fair to both sides. These may be precedent, other examples of it working, equal choice by each side, one's not dominating the other, so forth. Then you've got the substance of the negotiation understood of the problem. You then have a choice. Either make some commitments, actual promises that are going to be made and implemented, or you go to your best alternative with no agreement. So your BATNA, what is your BATNA, your best alternative to a negotiated agreement. And in each case, you want to understand each side. What will we commit to if we commit? And what happens if we don't reach agreement? So those seven elements are the essence of what one is dealing with in a conflict. And usually the diagnosis you can see, if I come in as a doctor, I can see there's either poor communication or people are focusing on their position, unity for Canada, sovereignty for Quebec, rather than on what they really care about, rather than their concerns, their wants, their needs. They tend to have two options, I win or you win. It's a win-lose. You tend to force it, and the media helps do that too. Force it into an either-or position.
Right.
And, or they can't decide what a fair standard is. In Kosovo, they could decide whether it's sovereignty or human rights. You know, human rights standards is also, you don't go bombing sovereign countries. And they have different criteria they're using by which to judge the conduct. So, and then you got to figure out what happens if we don't reach agreement. And, I was working the last month on Kosovo, and that the alternatives were not very good. And, or you have the kind of commitments you want people to make. And those are the kind of things they're only worrying about now. How do you stage the military coming in, the military going out? How do you get refugees to come in without getting the KLA coming in? How do you get the buildings there, houses, in time for the refugees who want to return? So, if you try to draft an agreement that the other side could sign, realize we had no idea what the actual agreement would look like. We're going to win a war or lose a war. So the more you one works on what are some possible commitments, some interim commitments. We will stop bombing for 48 hours if during that period you move some equipment out. We'll suspend the bombing for another 5 days. And so we could actually have to turn these problems into possible answers. And it helps to have people who are not, whatever their authority is in normal life, here they're not the president of the country, and here they have no authority to commit anybody except themselves to what they'll recommend. And that means that the learning, the relationship, and the understanding are all without a big political consequences. So you then can work on it.
Mm-hmm.
I got some materials on this stuff if your organization you're working for would like.
Very much.
Would like some on facilitated joint brainstorming.
Very much. May I give you my address?
Yeah, just a second. Let me. I got so many things going on.
Great.
But what I'm trying to devote myself to is to spread the skills of dealing with differences. And that's what we have a nonprofit firm across the street from the law school that, which is the one I actually went to Spokane. Harvard University, as Harvard University, doesn't go off and do things like that. So when I'm off with Ecuador and Peru, with their boundary dispute, I'm doing our conflict management group. Although I bring this stuff back and teach the students how to do it.
Well, there are a couple of nitty-gritty questions that occur to me after after reading the McLean's project. So I just want to ask these to you in real broad terms. Does your process of negotiation, what you modeled there with McLean's, illuminate any new possibilities for governance and for humanity as a whole? And how would you describe those?
I think, well, the important points I have is people separate their interests from their position. They look, they've taken a position for sovereignty or taken a position for autonomy. What are their real concerns? And in practical terms, I was working with President Shevardnadze in the breakaway unrecognized government of South Ossetia, and there if you want to be a sovereign state. I was talking to him when I was there. I said, you mean really sovereign like a country? Oh yes, UN membership? He said, of course. I said, well, what's your budget? This is about, you know, a few thousand people. What's your budget for a UN office? He said, doesn't the UN pay for that? And I said, no, the UN does not pay for that. And I said, who's going to regulate aircraft safety? The licensing of dentists and doctors. And many people who want sovereignty haven't thought of all who among the people they know in their area have the competence to license drugs or to do other things. And they haven't thought about it. So you have to find out what they really care. They care about not having the Georgians barge in and kill them. They care about respect for their language, things of that kind. So it's separating interests from positions. It separates the inventing of things from committing, brainstorming from committing. You have to brainstorm. Now, it's very hard for presidents to sit down and brainstorm without one of them says, I got a great idea. Other one says, I accept it, and before they even thought about it at all. So you have to have a carefully considered brainstorming of a wide range of ideas, and that's a separate, takes place at a separate time and a place from committing, making binding commitments. That encourages inventing the best solution. So those critical things are really important. Do you know a little book of mine called Getting to Yes?
Yes.
That's got a lot of it in it, although in the last 20 years I've learned something.
Mm-hmm.
See, and I think there's certainly room for governments, if they have to, they have some. I mean, Ecuador, Peru, the president of Ecuador, 95, when I talked about a situation, there were only two options on the table, either win or lose. And I said, is the current process going to generate more options? He said, no, I refuse to talk to Fujimori. And I said, how about some facilitated joint brainstorming? I ran through that operation, speaking of the National Security Council down there, and went up afterwards and thanked him for the chance to talk. What about joint brainstorming? He said, do it. He said, who do you want from Ecuador? And I said, well, I've gotten to know your chief of staff, Carlos, fairly well. I thought I'd ask his advice. He said, take Carlos, he's terrific. I said, he's your chief of staff. He said, find his city correctly. No commitments can be made? Fine, take Carlos. Who else do you want? I want a military man. Well, General Sandoval knows you. Take him. He won't wear his uniform at Harvard. You're right. So we took these fairly significant people engaged in this activity, and they became more important. And they got more deeply involved. But the separation of thinking about possibilities as separate from making concessions and negotiating, that's very important. Now, it helps, I've found, to have a third party like me running the meeting, because unless they're well experienced in this, they tend to fall back into arguing. Arguing about what happened or what's right and what's wrong or whose fault it is. rather than creatively thinking up some things that might be done. But when people, we've got a couple hundred people in Cyprus now who've been through the training, and they can work together by themselves, Greeks and Turks, on arranging some stuff, little things, at the lower level where they operate.
The process that McLean's used, having this highly competent sampling firm do these two things. One, come up with a dependable profile of the nation's psyche, identifying the dominant strains of thought. And then two, getting a statistically valid sampling of that psyche, and then arranging to sit down with those representatives under the guidance of expert facilitation like you. Why wouldn't every democracy in the world do that kind of thing routinely? In other words, why didn't Canada do that as a result of seeing that exercise? Why aren't we doing it in the U.S.? The Harvard negotiation project is well known, well respected. You certainly are. It seems as though you've identified a very exciting process to take democracy to the next frontier. Why aren't we doing that?
Well, let me just, I've not thought about it quite that way, so let me try. Mike, I think that the sampling of questions which was done before the McLean episodes tended to be asking people about their positions.
Mm-hmm.
And although they got a fair sample of these human beings, as human beings will, or more reasonable than the pollsters thought,
mm-hmm.
There's a group here in Cambridge been working on some difficult conversations like abortion. And they get people from both sides meeting. You know, they meet every couple of weeks for a while. They find out if they can move forward and understand each other, not reach out a compromise, but they maybe both work on reducing unwanted pregnancies. If the people identify themselves,
it's called Provincia, a little settlement half a dozen miles in the middle of the jungle, which Ecuador conquered and threw lost a couple hundred soldiers and in a retreat in defeat.
Well, what year was that?
January 95.
Uh-huh.
And the result is that the public opinion in Ecuador, when asked a year ago in June 98 if the negotiations with Peru, Ecuador could get everything it wanted in terms of access to the Amazon and a trade border station there, et cetera, but had to give up this little settlement of Tawinsa, should accept the treaty. 90% of the public opinion said no. In Peru, it was about 75% said no. We must never give up Tawinsa. It's where it's like the Alamo, you know, it's a great big battle. We have to keep it. Well, if you sampled public opinion on should we give up Tawinsa or not, we end up in a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing the concerns of the president and public opinion opposed to giving it up, but there's really nothing there. The houses got destroyed in the war. There was nothing there in the jungle at all, except the place name. Well, the solution we worked out was to say, okay, since it looks like the better boundary line that the disputing over is Peru has a better legal claim to Tawinsa, Tawinsa will be in, not on the edge, but in Peru. And then we drew a square kilometer around Tawinsa. And one square kilometer of land is owned by Ecuador in perpetuity. We could own an embassy building or something. So the present Mawad of Ecuador says, we didn't give it to UNSA, we own it forever. And President Fujimori said, we didn't give it to UNSA, it's part of our sovereign territory. Now, if you get people who've been arguing over a position for a long time, the public, the pollsters will not ask them, would they accept such an idea?
Could the polling process be refined to reflect that understanding?
Gee, the polling is almost always on positions.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be you can have concerns with individuals. What are you worried about? What are you doing? But the pollsters say, who are you going to vote for president? Bush or Mrs. Dole? And they don't say, are you worried about Bush's lack of experience? To realize the governor of Texas is the governor of all the union, has the least power to the governor. The commissioners run Texas. The governor greets people and does very little. You want a man with that little experience as being a chief executive? Well, you're right in the middle of arguing the case. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I find that if I take able, sensible people, not the extreme partisans on either edge, but people who are not just the great doves who will settle anything, but people who have points of view that are smart and will listen, they give me a week with them or give me several days with them, and they're sitting side by side at a table trying to work on something together. So I think that having able people who are very familiar with the concerns of their community, and however they're picked, McLean's did a good job of picking these people, and the fact that we had some politicians there didn't hurt, but I'm not sure whether you, on more and more issues, whether I want the polling, how dominant that would be. That was one of my concerns. It turned out not to be probably a bothersome there. But I think that you can take, however you select them, and having the legitimacy of polls help McLean. McLean is going to be a tough problem if they couldn't explain why these two were chosen. Therefore, they hired independent people to choose them. But when we picked Ecuadorians and Peruvians, we didn't have to justify that. And when in Georgia and South Ossetia, we picked some Georgians and some South Ossetians, we didn't have to defend that to anybody. The president said it kind of understood we hadn't picked their worst enemies on it.
How do you spell Ossetia?
Just the way Ossetia. Ossetia.
Thanks.
South Ossetia is on the south side of the Caucasus. And North Ossetia is on the north side of the Caucasus. And when Georgia was fighting for independence from the Soviet Union, which it succeeded in getting, South Ossetia was fighting for independence from Georgia and to join up with North Ossetia. But the Russians kept control over North Ossetia. So South Ossetia, after there was a time there, the Organization of Security and Cooperation of Europe, the OSCE, maintained a ceasefire line around South Ossetia to protect them from the Georgian rampant military who engaged in their own version of ethnic cleansing.
Mm-hmm.
At that time.
Mm-hmm. In a society like ours, in which the ethic has operated in the past, that what's good for General Motors is good for America. I don't know the extent to which that ethic is operating now, but it does clarify some of the classic interests that have defined our deliberation. In other words, the interests of government, the interests of economic players, and then the interests of citizens who have their own needs and concerns. What kind of, and first of all, is that a fair characterization of the critical parties involved? And secondly, if it is, or however you would add to it, what kind of enlightenment is needed on the part of all of those parties to make your process more accessible to the world?
Let me see. That's a big question. I find that if I can get people away from their constituents for a while, whether it's General Motors, away from the management of the union leaders, away from their constituents, and we discuss what to do about the upcoming labor situation between General Motors and the union, even between these polarized camps, you can do very well. At one point, I had the executive vice president, or I guess it was vice president of General Motors for labor relations, and the president of the UAW for General Motors. They have different presidents for Chrysler and so forth. And I had them both sitting here in my office, and I said, oh, gee, this is great. We worked for a while together, and I said, this is great. I got to get a photograph of this. And both of them said, not on your life. Our jobs are at stake if people found we were colluding together.
Wow.
And when we do it, the Greek and Turkish Cypriots together, we met in West Virginia for one time. We had to spend a full day of a week about their concerns about going home, having met with the enemy, and how they could justify it, and what they're going to say. The press knew the meeting was taking place, they'd find out about it. So the problem of re-immersion back in their community from this safe sanctuary where they could say what they thought and give up some ideas was a real problem. I'm trying to spread these techniques by example in South Africa, El Salvador, Ecuador, Peru, South Ossetia, and Georgia. And internally, we're doing some with gangs here in Boston, teaching people in middle school something, eighth grade, some of these skills. I think that the pattern that a tough negotiator is someone who takes a firm position. I mean, Madeleine Albright was saying, we're not negotiating, we're bombing, you know. There's no negotiation is a sign of weakness. I consider negotiation a sign of confidence. If we talk, we can work something out. It'll satisfy my interest.
Mm-hmm.
But the zero-sum aspect of negotiating, that I'm offering you $15 for that rocking chair, and that's all it is. Well, the price is $25, I'm sorry. You know, that model of how you negotiate is so widespread that it takes a lot of work to educate people. But it's really joint problem-solving. And we'll solve the problem better if you work on it together.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's the model of fear their constituents will think they gave in. And we will not be seen talking to Milosevic. Oh, God, he's the guy in charge in there.
Right.
How the hell do you settle this problem without listening and talking to him?
So this zero-sum habit of mind that exists in the world, if I'm understanding you correctly, is in itself one of the primary obstacles that you find yourself having to deal with, and one of the best ways you found of dealing with it is just by setting the example of what the alternative is and what the experience of that alternative is. Is that accurate?
Yeah, you get a number of people, significant people, who either talk to their bosses or they talk below them or they write to them, who understand it. And in South Africa, I did a workshop for the all-white cabinet of de Klerk, and then I did a workshop for the African National Congress. And when they started negotiating, the chief negotiator for the government was Rolf Meyer, Minister of Defense. The chief negotiator for the African National Congress was Cyril Ramaphosa, Secretary General of the ANC. And when there were other parties, minor parties, but the two of them were the major parties, and when they first met, there was a place they were going to meet together in a room to work and talk about things. And I went back a couple of years later to interview them, and Rolf said, I came into this room, and Cyril was already there. And I said, I hope you'll call me Rolf. May I call you Cyril? We got a lot of work to do. And there was a table there with one chair each side of it. I picked up the chair that Cyril was not in. I moved it around and put it next to him. That's on the same side of the table. I dumped my papers down. I said, we've got a lot of work to do, sitting side by side on that side of the table. You know what happened? I said, no, what happened? He said, Cyril burst out laughing. I said, laughing at you? He said, laughing with me. He said, boy, you took the same seminar I did. And the two of them, although they never came, they told me they'd never been over dinner themselves, one's black, one's white, they became very close professional colleagues, working colleagues, and people saw them on television working. And Cyril told me, was it last over there? So this has become a country negotiator.
Now, let me ask you something about this anecdote. What is it about that anecdote that is so touching? As you went through that just now, I got tears in my eyes. When you did the exercise at McLean's, people who felt great antagonism toward one another at the beginning wound up carefully hugging one another. What is that about?
My next book is going to be called Negotiating with Emotions. And it's really being aware of your own feelings and aware of the other side, and how do you enlist them in the exercise and working together. I was moved at the time. It's people who have seen themselves as adversaries, and something comes to humanity of them. They realize there's more to this person than that. This is a human being in the same situation I'm in some ways. No, it's terribly important to... The other day, a couple of weeks ago, I was talking to a bunch of Latin American people here, taking a three-day course up here on negotiation. And I asked them to prepare some questions that got answered on Friday. And one of the questions was, Professor Fisher, you're so damn rational. Where's the room for instinct and intuition? Where's your room for intuition then? And I thought it was a very good question. And I told him so, and went downstairs talking, and I said, well, there's inventing and there's deciding. I said, inventing, if an idea comes from your mind,
That's great. But check it out with your gut before you try it out. Does it feel right? If your intuition says do something, think about it before you try it. Use each one as a governor on the other. But don't kill it off newborn before it happens. Don't stifle it. Don't prevent it from that idea from being developed. And I think that you have to design a system where both good brains and human feeling can take over. And it can be felt and dealt with. No, it's very satisfying to be able to do this and to see the people hugging each other in Canada, to see the Ossetians and Georgians, to see the South Africans becoming, working with each other that way. It takes time to break out of this set assumptions, which are we're enemies, the positions are what count, this must look tough, and must not give in. All those assumptions of the standard game of problem of conflict, carrying out a conflict. And I find sitting on the same side of the table has an enormous impact. I got president of Ecuador, he went down to meet Fujimori for the first time. I said, I want a photograph when you come back. He said, oh, there'll be plenty of photographs to take a shaking hands. And I said, no, on a photograph of the two of you sitting down, both looking at the same piece of paper, a pad of paper, and with a pencil out there, and you're both talking about that piece of paper. And he came back with a front page photograph of that from Bolivia. It's okay, Roger, it's okay. That's exactly right. There'll be thousands of people who have their vision of adversaries changed when they see the two of you working together with a pad of paper in front of you. That'll change their perception of what's going on. And at the signing, I told somebody else at lunch, I didn't tell you about signing the Ecuador-Peru agreement, did I? In Brasilia?
No, sir.
Well, when Fujimori was the first to speak, and he said there are many people to be congratulated and thanked for the help they've given us in settling this 57-year-old boundary dispute. But the one I want to thank the most is the woman who raised her son to be the president of Ecuador. They left the lectern and went down to the second row where the president's mother was sitting down and gave her a very Latin, un-Japanese kiss. And 800 of you went wild.
Wow.
They couldn't believe it.
Wow.
But that notion of I want to thank the woman who raised her son to be the president of Ecuador. And that kind of bringing humanity into it is terribly important.
Yeah. Well, that's a good note to end on. That gives me what I was looking for.
Okay. You've got play there. I'll send stuff. What's the name of this organization? Want this done more. I find I have a hard time getting funding for a nonprofit because
right.
The world the way it is.
Right.
And typically, we call rapid response fund. There's an opportunity to do something, and a foundation takes months to consider something. And so there's stuff we can't do because we haven't got the rapid response funding available. And they may have been interested in, learning more about this. And is their focus on conflict resolution?
Yes. And beyond that, I mean, I would say conflict resolution is inevitably a component. But as the name of the organization implies, their real thrust is
as the executive director, Tom Attlee, puts it, instead of experiencing co-stupidity, which is what humanity mostly experiences, actually experiencing the synergism of ideas, experience, etc., that tangibly results in co-intelligence. And, you know, that's what they're exploring.
I say my current slogan is, solutions are not the answer, it's process.
Uh-huh.
And that people argue over the past, or when they quarrel about the future, they're quarreling as to which is the right answer. And there are no answers that will end all conflicting interests and perceptions. The answer is how we deal with others when we have differences. And that, and I think it means it's you listen, you talk, you converse, you use help from third parties when you can, to deal with your problem in a way which does not humiliate either side, and let's go forward. So that the framing of the world's problems as who has the right answer, what is the solution going to be? How is the future of Kosovo, what's the solution going to be? And it's really how we work together to figure out the next stage in its history. How we work together to deal with those concerns. How we put something in place. The one thing that the military generals left out on going into Kosovo was the internal dispute resolution. If anybody has a problem with the Russians, here's the committee, here's their phone number on a cell phone. You call them up and say, hey, we got a problem there. And a committee of four or five people comes over and they discuss it and see if they can work something out.
Right.
But you have to have a process for dealing with other than pulling guns on each other.
Right. Well, I'm sure...
You've got better friends in the military than I have.
Well, those come from some pretty good sources.
No, that's the... Well, see, that... But the fact that the frame of reference of the public and the leadership may be influenced by the public, still has who is the enemy, who's more powerful, how to make them do what we want them to do. And who's good, who are good guys, we are, who are bad guys, Milosevic is a bad guy. And I think the co-intelligence, the common sense, common sense of applying to both sides, is what we're looking for. And it needs articulation. It needs to be spelled out in understandable terms. I think one reason the little book Get It a Yes is so popular is that it puts some of these ideas in very simple terms.
Right.
Very simple language.
Right.
Got to continue to sell. It sells over 100,000 copies every year.
My goodness.
This is, it came out in, what, 81?
Right.
But it's sort of organized common sense. And to me, I would articulate, I'd try to get the Co-Intelligence Institute to articulate the assumptions that are being made that are wrong, which underlie why we go to war in Kosovo and why do we think that some anti-missile missiles will be the salvation of the United States. And look at those assumptions and look at some better assumptions. And then the question is, how do you spread the better ones around? How do you make people realize it?
Right.
So that's a good challenge they have.
Well, Professor Fisher,
you really ought to come to Harvard, and we'll. You're not free next week. I'm giving a 5-day course here on open course.
What an offer. My gosh.
Well, this is for people, this is lawyers and others.
Right.
5-day basic course on negotiation.
Wow.
All day, every day for 5 days.
Wow. Well, that's a very generous offer. My deadline will preclude me taking you up on it, but maybe there will be an opportunity to do it at another time.
I do one in the fall, around the elections, first November in the fall. It'll be a fly-out week for law students, so the buildings are empty, and I can round up another 100 people and break them into sections and do it.
I'd love to do that.
Well, I'm glad to have someone who thinks that there's intelligence in this, these ideas that needs to be spread around.
Well,
I'll shoot some stuff to you, and you'll fax me back if you have something. You can print it without clearing it with me, but I'll try and check it and sharpen it up and clarify some. If I've been speaking too loosely and not precisely enough.
Thank you very much. I'll certainly take advantage of that offer.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Professor.
Good to talk. Thanks.
Thank you, sir.